The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. After reading a portion of Colin Thubron's new book, I began sifting through some online reviews for a complimentary and heartfelt quote to end my introduction. And the thing I quickly noticed was that the review aggregator that I was reading had a little green star next to every single review of both Shadow of the Silk Road and To a Mountain in Tibet. I decided to conduct a random survey of some of Mr. Thubron's colleagues, and not a single one produced the same result. Even the publishing and library trade journals starred their reviews for his new book. So rather than tell you about his seven novels, multiple awards, nine previous travelogues, I'll remind you that his writing is often called poetic, evocative, exquisite, and moving. And I'll leave you with the heartfelt quote that I mentioned a moment ago. Reviewing for the Boston Globe, fellow novelist and travel writer Bob Shikokas says in To a Mountain in Tibet, Thubron walks for the dead and writes for the living. And I can't remember when I have been so thoroughly and deeply moved by an author's outward journey inward. I trust you'll feel the same. Please welcome Colin Thubron.
Thank you. And thank you for coming on an evening like this in particular. I feel that I should start with both a warning and an apology. The apology is that in spite of this promising-looking screen beside me, I have just one slide to show you, and that is a map. The warning, since I'm a travel writer, comes in the words of Dorothy Sayers, who said this about meeting her fellow authors. What we make is more important than what we are, especially if making is our profession. People are always imagining that if they can only get hold of the author and, so to speak, shake him long enough and hard enough, something exciting and illuminating will drop out of him. But it doesn't. Or, in the terser words of Margaret Atwood, if you like pate, don't bother to meet the duck. Well, nevertheless, here goes. In 1715, a Jesuit missionary who was traveling east from Kashmir towards Lhasa came upon, he writes, a mountain of excessive height and great circumference, always enveloped in cloud, covered with snow and ice, and most horrible, barren, steep, and bitterly cold. The Tibetans walk devoutly around the base of the mountain, which takes several days, and they believe this will bring them great indulgences. Owing to the snow on this mountain, my eyes became so inflamed that I well nigh lost my sight. He, in 1715, was the first European to set eyes on Mount Kailash. Yet it was already sacred to one-fifth of humankind, to all Buddhists and Hindus, to the Jain and the Bon. In the very ancient Hindu scriptures, long before Christ, we find there's a mystic mountain. And from this mountain flow all the four great rivers that nourish the universe. It was a mountain that was unplaced geographically at that time, but they felt that everything created, whether it's rocks, trees, or human beings, found its blueprint here. And in time, probably about 1,000 years ago, this mystic mountain of scripture became associated with the earthly mountain Kailash, which is a strange, almost isolated mountain north of the great Himalayan range that might, you think, have been placed there almost by divine intent. It's so beautiful and so isolated. Moreover, the four great rivers of the Indian subcontinent, the northernmost source of the Ganges, the Brahmaputra, the Indus, and the Sutlej, the great tributary of the Indus, all by some strange, almost geographical fluke, lies within about 70 miles of the summit of Mount Kailash. So Indians ascending the Himalayas, as Indian ascetics did, looking for sanctity in the great mountains, would eventually arrive, if they survived at all, with amazement at Mount Kailash. And so, in a sense, was discovered the heart of the world. It was nobody knows when the first pilgrims came, but it became so sacred in law that a single circuit of the mountain was said to abolish the sins of a lifetime. In legend, too, the Buddha himself arrived at Kailash and nailed the mountain to earth with his footprints before demons could carry it away. Meanwhile, Hindus believed that it was sacred to the great god of change, destruction and change, the great god Shiva, whose palace was said to be on the top of Mount Kailash, where Shiva meditated eternally. Although sometimes in the holy lake below, he was said to float as a golden swan. Yet the god of death dwells on the mountain too. Nothing is total, nothing is eternal, not even he. Everything is flux. Kailash was dangerous to reach, but it was never quite inaccessible. Only in the 19th century, in fact, did Tibet become a kind of forbidden land, probably prompted by Chinese xenophobia and Nepalese isolationism. And it slopes a sacrosanct. It keeps its own taboos. It's never been climbed. In recent years, it's been protected, of course, less by sanctity than by political intolerance. In 1962, 4 years before the Cultural Revolution, the Chinese banned all pilgrimage to it, although, in fact, pilgrims still circled the mountain in secret. In 1981, they did allow a few Hindu and Buddhist pilgrims to return there, but it wasn't for another 12 years before tentative parties of trekkers were allowed over the Nepalese border to the mountain. My motive has a rather dark undertow, which I find difficult to explain or to make logical, even in the book. The Swiss writer Nicolas Bouvier wrote that you think you are making a trip, but soon it is making you, or unmaking you. And mine, certainly my journey, was a kind of, if you like, a secular pilgrimage, which I find quite difficult to talk about. And only to say that most of my books, all of them, in fact, my travel books, critics have tended to say, he never speaks about himself. We don't discover anything about himself in these books. Well, after this one, they'll probably go back to saying, please be impersonal. We don't want to know any more about you. But I think people have always acknowledged that pilgrimage, personal pilgrimage, has motives that are not necessarily those of simple piety or repentance. There's a feeling that by walking closer to the earth, simply by contact with the earth, this slowing down of one's life to the natural rhythm of walking is like a rite in itself, as walking may be. Kierkegaard wrote that, above all, do not lose your desire to walk. I have walked myself into my best thoughts. By sitting still, the closer one comes to feeling ill. Thus, if one keeps on walking, everything will be all right. By detaching ourselves from our accustomed home also, I think we start to see that home for what it is, a kind of way station in our existence. Pilgrimage, in other words, can be a preparation for death. And a mountain, of course, is particularly potent, whether one's talking about the Himalayas of the Hindus and Buddhists or the Olympus of the ancient Greeks. The ascent of a mountain is to approach divinity. Robert McFarlane writes that the equation of height with goodness is embedded in our language and consequently in the way we think. We move up or we sink down. One does not, under any linguistic circumstances, progress down. Although not always, an anonymous dissenter does remark, When a man's circumference bears more than a certain ratio to his altitude, he prefers the plains. Well, most of us are, I think, prisoners of this private inherited faith that you might call the sublime. In Europe, mountains were certainly obvious objects of extreme dread. One reads of pilgrims in the 16th and even 17th centuries who would cross the Alps blindfold so that they wouldn't be made dizzy by the horrors that were around them. And yet, of course, by the late 18th century, mountains are beginning to be almost like objects of secular worship, as if they were reflections of God's grandeur. And my journey, I know, was following just such a trajectory, climbing the great valley of the Karnali River, which is the highest source of the Ganges, through northwest Nepal towards this sacred mountain. My motives, I can say, can hardly be made logical. They were spurred by the death of my mother and the realization that all my family, which had once been very tight-knit, were gone. Nothing unusual, this, you'd say, a man of my age, having no parents or even siblings left. But I wanted in some way to mark it or to break up the trajectory of my life by doing something, and something physical. And I can almost not make it more logical than that. And because this motive is so complicated and a little bit painful, I think I shall read the passage that attempts to explain it. My Sherpa asks, and you, why are you doing this, he asks, traveling alone? I cannot answer. Sometimes journeys begin long before their first step is taken. Mine, without my knowing, starts not long ago in a hospital ward as the last of my family dies. There's nothing strange in this, the state of being alone. The death of parents may bring resigned sadness, even a guilty freedom. Instead, I need to leave a sign of their passage. My mother died just now, it seems, not in the way she wished. My father before her, my sister before that, at the age of 21. The Sherpa's eyes stay mute on me, puzzled. Solitude here is an unsought peril. I joke, nobody's fool enough to travel with me. It is already evening. Our feet grate over the stones. You cannot walk out your grief, I know, or absolve yourself of your survival, or bring anyone back. You are left with the desire only that things not be as they are. So you choose somewhere meaningful on the earth's surface, as if planning a secular pilgrimage. Yet the meaning is not your own. Then you go on a journey, it's my profession after all, walking to a place beyond your own history, to the sound of the river flowing the other way. In the end, you come to rest at a mountain that is holy to others. The reason for this is beyond articulation. A journey is not a cure. It brings an illusion only of change and becomes, at best, a Spartan comfort. The Sherpa looks robust, but he stops to complain quaintly of a mosquito bite on his hand, splaying his fingers for my inspection. They are chubby as a baby's, I tell him. We laugh and go on. To ask of a journey why is to hear only my own silence. It is the wrong question, although there seems no other. Am I harrowing myself because the world is mortal? Whose pain am I purging? Not theirs. An old Tibetan monk tells me the soul has no memory. The dead do not feel their past. Meanwhile, the sun is setting with a perverse radiance behind us. This shows the trajectory of this quite short, sharp journey that I was undertaking, starting from there and ending at Kailash up here. This area of Nepal was overrun by Maoist guerrillas until a few years before, but now it was quite easily accessible again. You arrive at this little place, Simikot, in a twin otter aircraft. There are no roads in this area at all. And I went in a rather Raj-style fashion, which is about the minimum people you can take, with a Sherpa, a cook, and a horseman. Staying with families along the way, mostly Nepalese Buddhists and Hindus. It's a wonderful valley, this Karnali here, tremendous trees, great hemlocks and firs, sometimes 150 feet above you, and strange, rather English sort of noises, cuckoos and woodpeckers sounding in the woods. And sometimes, in fact, you get the illusion of walking through a rather overgrown English garden, for me, full of rock roses, a mimosa, syringa, honeysuckle. And this is no surprise, of course, because generations of Himalayan botanists had crated up these specimens and brought them back to Europe. The villages here look lovely. They're stone and log-built, banked against the mountainside, and usually reached by little ladders of notched logs, rather as in American pueblos in the south. The sad thing is, of course, and this is the quandary of the traveller, that poverty almost seems to be a condition of the picturesque. You go and stay in these, with these families, as I did sometimes, and you learn that life is very bitter. For months of the year, they're locked up in their little houses by winter snows, and the land they have is squeezed in the mountain, in this river valley. They're lucky to have a patch of rice. Usually it's a patch of barley. Many can't make ends meet, and they do so by felling these beautiful forests, of course, and taking the logs up on the backs of yaks and ponies to sell to a treeless Tibet over the border there. The Maoists, fortunately, had gone, but they had already killed 13,000 Nepalese, taken those 13,000 Nepalese lives, and occasionally held Western trekkers to ransom, but never harmed them. And they had taken away with them all the danger of this area, I think. The only time that I imagined that I was going to be have any trouble was when we were approaching a village with my Sherpa, and I asked him, can we stay with people here? And he said, we stay with family, you will die here. And I said, die here? Who's going to kill me? And he said, I did not say die here. He said, you will diarrhea if we stay with family. We did diarrhea, of course. And but that was the closest that I got to any sort of trouble. What happened was the most beautiful transition along this river as you go approach the Tibetan border. The trees fade away, and you're in a plateau land, which is the Tibetan plateau, basically, an almost lunar landscape in which the lakes, those fine lakes up there, are sort of carved out, treeless, like great abstract feats of sculpture. As you start getting into Tibetan air, you find prayer flags streaming in the high passes and from the rooftops, prayer flags which are inscribed with prayers which the wind touches, and they're meant magically to disseminate into the air to bring benevolence to all living things. You see mani walls too. These are walls of they're not enclosing anything. They're simply walls of stones, and every stone on the surface of them is inscribed with a prayer, hundreds of them. And they're mostly inscribed with the Buddhist prayer, Om Mani Padme Hum, this petition to the goddess of compassion, it is really. And if you walk around these walls, it is said, you activate the prayers, all the prayers in them again, just by one circumambulation, and they too disseminate in the air, so that my Sherpa said the walls were whispering behind us. Well, you cross the border at 13,000 feet, and I had to go to wait for a day or two until a party of British trekkers caught me up that I knew was behind me, because the Chinese won't allow people over the border alone. They feel they can control a group, but not an individual. And you're absolutely confronted by two cultures here staring you in the face on the border. The Chinese officials, very smart, very correct, very proper, but exuding a kind of cultural superiority to the warm and poverty-stricken Tibetans all around them. You could feel them. There's a rosy-cheeked captain, I remember, with surgical gloves, who went through my rucksack looking for pictures of the Dalai Lama. That's the thing they fear. They don't want you to take pictures of the Dalai Lama into Tibet. It's like a sort of icon. And You can feel they are bringing civilization, they feel, to this country. They've been told that this is a land of feudal serfs with a life expectation of 36, that they're all drunk and illiterate and superstitious and so on. And the Chinese feel that they are bringing all the modern benefits that we enjoy, good medical care, education, and so on. This is what they feel, that they might be putting a knife into the heart of Tibetan culture by downgrading and despising its Buddhism doesn't seem to matter to them. Our last exit from the frontier was to go into a tent which was monitoring us for swine fever. And I remember that the last thing we had to do was to fill out a little questionnaire whose rather quaint translated Mandarin included the question you had to answer was, have you had close relations with pig during 1 week? So at last we moved into Tibet after being absolved of close relations with the pig, and a beautiful violet-tinged landscape, a great plateau. You realize then how isolated Tibet is, how to the south of it is the great Himalayan range, to the north the Kunlun, which descends into the Chinese deserts, to the west the Karakoram, and even in the east, hundreds of miles of virtually inaccessible mountains. Tibet used to be a sea 45 million years ago. This was the Tethys Sea. And as the Indian subcontinent, which was then free-floating, crashed into the bottom of Asia and pushed up the Himalayas, so this sea becomes isolated and eventually drains away. And even now, in the cliff strata of Tibet, you can see marine fossils showing that this, the highest country in the world, was once an ocean. Well, the far west, which is where we were going, it's called Nagari. It is the least populated part of Tibet, and in many ways the most bitter. It's 3 miles above sea level, and the sun's radiation is so strong that the heat literally surges from the earth, drawing in icy winds and a terrible sort of sandpaper wind that smooths the hill land. And the temperature changes are so abrupt that rocks literally splinter and the cliffs are kind of pulverized. So it's a country where, as they say, you can get sunstroke and frostbite at once. We could have the map off, I think. Thank you. Like most travelers to Tibet, I was the inheritor of a extraordinary mystique. I think all of us are, and it's clung on. It goes back to the 19th century, primarily, when Tibet was indeed a properly forbidden land. Nepal was isolationist at that time, and there was a Chinese xenophobia about foreigners, and this affected Tibet, and it became this land that was impossible to penetrate. And so, of course, its mystique grew in the West until virtually no Westerners got in except by subterfuge or in disguise. But those who did reported a land of pious primitives. There was a sort of schizophrenia about these people almost. On the one hand, here was a land ruled by monks, supposedly benign monks, and yet these people were so backward that the only wheels they had were for creating prayer, literally prayer wheels. And there was a sense, too, that they were licentious and sexually depraved because they practiced polyandry, a woman having many husbands, as they still do. So the Victorian English, as you can imagine, were in some horror at them. Then in the late 19th century, just as scholarship begins to find a more porous Tibet, you find a strange kind of mystique, again, brewing up a sort of fascination and a pouring in of Western fantasies into Tibet. Madame Blavatsky, the sort of pseudo-mystic, was supposed to have been speaking to a hidden brotherhood of Tibetan seers who were somewhere out there. And Tibet was thought of by then as a sort of laboratory of the paranormal, as if they sort of really studied it. There were monks who levitated and flew, it was said. There were lamas who could split boulders with their voices or perform great feats of telepathy. There were the Lungpa, the wind men, who could drift across the landscape with their feet barely touching the earth, and prophetic texts which had been buried in the landscape to be rediscovered when the historical time was ripe, and so on. And as the 20th century comes, and Europe, of course, reels through two world wars, America too, then Tibet becomes a sort of shining example of somewhere beautiful and lost. We find Kipling's Kim, for instance, imbued with the mysticism of Tibet as a kind of Shangri-La. And Sherlock Holmes, when Conan Doyle kills off Sherlock Holmes, he's forced by popular demand to bring him back to life. And where should he decide to send him in the interval? Where was the country that he couldn't possibly be discovered but Tibet? And so this country becomes, by about the 1930s, 40s, certainly, a place of pure human longing. James Hilton's Lost Horizon, published in 1933, imagined it a land whose prophets would emerge one day after the world was destroying itself to bring it back to a kind of redemption. And above all, the country's Buddhism, which Victorians had considered a sort of depraved cousin, a distant cousin of the real Buddhism, was thought to be instead a kind of isolated, pure Buddhism, the kind of pinnacle of a very refined faith which had got taken advantage of Tibet's isolation and had been preserved there as if time had stopped. But it wasn't always so. Tibet has a history of some violence. In the 7th, 8th centuries, the Tibetan Empire spread from Tang Dynasty China. They actually sacked Xi'an, the capital of Tang Dynasty China, where the Terracotta Warriors are today, and their armies reached the borders of Burma. The Tibetan armor was the finest in the world, and they could muster 200,000 men at a touch. Even in the 14th, 15th centuries, we find that the monastic communities are almost like armed camps fighting for their particular version of Buddhism. And into the early 20th century, the Dalai Lamas, if they weren't complicit in violence, were sometimes killed as children. It's only, I think, with our present Dalai Lama that we feel that post is a paragon of peacefulness and goodwill. Well, the monks, of course, as we know from the Olympic riots 2 years ago, are often the spearhead of revolt. Our idea of Tibetan monks or of any monks is that they are peaceful and benign. But I remember I made friends with monks in Kathmandu, where there's a big Tibetan Buddhist community. And I remember a monk telling me, you know, we're not like this, you know, there's a sort of energy in our Buddhism and energy in our characters. You should just see the monks watching television, he said. I said, what? And he said, well, you know, they love football. And they love your British team, Manchester United, he said. They're all fans of Manchester United. And they got very angry last night because they thought the referee was giving out unfair penalty tickets. And they were shouting at the screen and waving their hands. And I said, I thought the monks were meditating in the evening. And he said, no, well, you know, maybe a kind of meditation, he said. You know, they concentrate on the ball and the rest of the world goes away. Well, the first sight of Mount Kailash is of a great dome floating far away over two extraordinary lakes. One is called Rakashtal, the Lake of Demons, which is supposed to be haunted by Hindu carnivorous spirits. And the other, Manasarova, is the holy lake that's carved out like a great feat of abstract sculpture, 54 miles round in circumference, much the biggest freshwater lake in the world at that height, at 15,000 feet. It's so sacred that no fishing may be done there, nobody may sail on it, nobody may even hunt its shores, which are completely empty. So you descend to it, and there are all these seabirds round the shore, terns, gulls, Brahmani ducks, coots, and they're so tame that you almost have to kick them out of the way. It's quite enchanting. And this mountain, Kailash, is reflected in the Manasa of our lake there. And Hindus believe that this strange phallic dome, as they imagine the mountain, finds its wedding with Manasava in the vagina of the dark waters of the lake. The lake, they say, was created by the mind of God, by Brahma. It's the fruit of first consciousness. And sometimes the Buddhists imagine that the Buddha's mother descended to the lake and before giving birth to him, as if the lake was in some way his father. And, as I say, Shiva, to the Hindus, floats here as a golden swan. There are a few monasteries around it. They were all destroyed in the Cultural Revolution in 1966, mostly rebuilt now, but home only to very few monks, maybe four or five at the most, of these impoverished, quiet men. I think they were always small. The lake is in actually more sacred even to the Hindus than the Buddhists, but these, of course, are little Buddhist monasteries. And in the past century, they were only inhabited by very few. One in particular, a traveller remarks, says just a single monk was left there, all alone in this isolation, who would sound a great bronze bell over the waters every morning, heard by nobody at all. But by a freak of geography, these four great rivers of the Indian subcontinent all rise at the base of Mount Kailash. And their origin baffled explorers for centuries and rather mesmerized British Imperial India. But the explorer who bestrode this whole area was not British at all. He was the Swede, Sven Hedin, a man of almost sort of blinding self-glamour, imagined himself a sort of sublime hero. And in 1907, he reached Manasarava after a journey that had filled in 65,000 miles of a Tibet unknown to the west, which he named the mountains there, the Trans-Himalaya. And 100 of his pack animals died within about 6 weeks of his departing. When at last he came back to Europe, trumpeting his discovery of the source of all the four great rivers, he was given a dreadful mauling by the premier body of geographers at the time, the Royal Geographical Society in London. In fact, his discovery of the source of the Indus was validated, but all the others were decried. He had, in fact, I think, sabotaged his own discoveries by elevating them in the cold gaze of the British. The source of the Brahmaputra had actually been discovered by a rather jaunty British hunting party 40 years before. And so he fades away from popular annals to be rediscovered later as a great explorer, even though his Trans-Himalayan mountains were downgraded and considered not to be worthy of a Himalayan name. Beside the lake, this beautiful lake of Manasarava, I wandered off and found high in the cliffs these caves. You scramble up the cliff and there's a sort of weathered door rattling in the cave. You go in and there's a sort of wonky flue of some primitive oven. Once or twice I found bags of rice left behind, little bags of salinated earth which had been gathered piously from the side of the lake and so on. And these were places where hermits had, and still occasionally did, meditate. This meditation is the heart of the Tibetan Buddhism, called Vajrayana, the diamond vehicle, they call it, because of the swiftness with which it brings illumination. It's a very complex and very disciplined and, I think, very sophisticated tradition and requires extreme solitude and I think a great strength of mind. It means, really, that within a single lifetime, and this is a horrifically short time to a conventional Buddhist. The adept can overleap all these cycles of reincarnation and enter nirvana at a stroke. But as I approached Kailash, it was a very different sort of worship that I encountered, not this pious and solitary one, but a communal one. It was Sagadawa, the Buddhist holy month, and there were 1,000 pilgrims assembled under the mountain, and they were celebrating the raising of a great pole, an 80-foot pole of pine trees lashed together, which had to be pulled upright, and if it remained absolutely vertical in its socket of stones, it meant it was a good augury for Tibet for the future year. If it was a little bit aslant, that was a bad omen. During the Cultural Revolution, when pilgrimage and this ceremony had been banned, of course, it didn't happen at all, which increased the idea that this was a very potent symbol of what would happen to Tibet. The Chinese army had penetrated and were rather brutally and offensively kind of monitoring this program. The Tibetans were looking straight through them as if they didn't exist. It was an extraordinary thing to witness. A couple of hundred soldiers, 1,000 pilgrims. The pilgrims went on celebrating as if neither the army trucks nor the army guards nor the swaggering patrols of Chinese soldiers, just as if they weren't there. The ceremony of raising that pole is probably a very old shamanistic one of loss and death. There's an ancient idea that heaven and earth were once joined together, either by a pole, a ladder, or a tree. And at some tragic time in history, this link between the upper and the lower world was severed. They believe, the Tibetans, that their early kings came down with cords of light attached to their heads from heaven, but that somehow the cords were severed and heaven and earth were forever after separated. Tibetan ways of death, of course, have haunted the West imagination. Probably the only book that any Tibetan text any of us have read has been the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which had a great power, even to Jung, who said that it was a sort of Bible for him. He carried it about with him and imagined that perhaps those ancient lamas had twitched the veil from the greatest mystery of all, which was death and resurrection. Another feature of the Tibetan attitude to death is sky burial, which we find so strange and repugnant in the West. This is a very frozen land, and to bury the dead is very hard. The tradition has always been, for almost all Tibetans, that they are fed to vultures. The body is cut up, the bones are pulverized, and literally fed to vultures on what they call a sky burial plateau. The sky burial master is considered a very refined but also a reviled occupation, at once revered and also feared and loathed. I went up to one of these plateaus beneath Mount Kailash, and it was desperately cold, I remember, and there were vulture feathers flying in the wind, and clothes, too. People had left garments there as reminders to Yama, the god of death, that he look after them through their next reincarnation. And there was an old couple there, I remember, wandering about, and nobody else there. And I waited for a bit, and then I saw, quite a way away, a man who I think must have been some sort of yogi or shaman. He was casting roasted barley into the air. He had his back turned to Kailash. He wasn't praying to Kailash. He's praying to the cemetery. And then he rolled in the dust in a great revolving mad revolution, on and on in the dust of the dead, it seemed. And what he was probably doing was to be telling the Gompos, who are the lords of the cemetery, these are the sort of they're kind of demonic spirits in a way. But he was, I think, asking them, this is the tradition, to devour his ego and to speed him on to salvation. After he'd gone, I walked over to where he'd been and was disturbed to find an axe and various wide-bladed knives simply lying discarded on the plateau, and then came to a board with knife scars on it where the bodies had been cut up, and underneath the board found the arm bones of a human with blood and flesh still on them. Now, the Tibetan sky masters are meant to be masters of their craft, but in this case, enigmatically, it wasn't so. And everything on this plateau suggested, I'm afraid, a crude carelessness. The ascent of mountains in many cultures, from ancient Egypt to Aboriginal Australia, means death. The mountain path, they say, is the road of the dead. The Assyrian name for mountain for dying was to grasp the mountain. Today, even, conventional Japanese funerals start with the words, Yamaguchi, we go to the mountain. The Hindu saying, to depart for Kailash, is also a synonym for death. A mountain certainly can suggest a closer contact with the bereaved. I find this hard to talk about. Strangely, the personal is easier to confide to a book, which is such an intimate relationship, in a way, between reader and writer, than it is to a public platform. Sufficient to say that if somebody preoccupies you on a journey, as my family was doing, their voices and their memories will surface along the way. The mountain's never been climbed, or never, in the crude mountaineer's terminology, conquered. There have been some lone attempts. In 1926, an Indian Army officer wanted to ascend it. He likened the mountain to a bowler hat, and he went off with his Sherpa, who was called Satan, and they attempted to climb it when were thrown back by hail and lightning, a sort of freak storm. About 20 years later, another British Army officer wanted to go up with nothing more than a furled umbrella, and he also failed. Later, predictably, Reinhold Messner, the great Tyrolean mountaineer, wanted to climb it, but the Chinese prevaricated. It was simply, they realized the anger that it would call in Tibet, and so that initiative disappeared. And to this day, that mountain peak, 22,000 feet high, remains unscaled. Hindu and Buddhist pilgrims circle it. They go clockwise. They go to accrue merit, and they go sometimes asking something specific. They want something from the mountain, whether it's the birth of another yak or a better harvest or for disease to leave their cattle or whatever it may be. It can be quite a practical desire. And it's said that a single circuit of the mountain will dispel the sin even of the murder of a parent or a lama. In the past, rich people would send a proxy around the mountain in their stead, and the merit would divide 50% to the person who'd done it and 50% to the person who had paid for it. And even now, if you go around the mountain on a pony or a yak, half the merit will go to the beast. It's about 33 miles around the base. It takes the Hindus 3 or 4 days, as it takes Westerners. The Tibetans, astonishingly, because of their lungs and blood makeup, can do the whole thing in 36 hours. And they go around twirling prayer wheels, sometimes with dogs and children with them, and seem wonderfully happy and elevated by it. When my Sherpa and I arrived, hoping to find a yak or something to stack our tent on, we were told the area had run out of yaks. So we had to pile the tents on his shoulders and my cook's, and we went round that way. The mountain from a distance appears to be a dome, but in fact it's a pyramid, and the southern face is beautiful and has this strange geological formation on it that looks like a stairway, as if it's a place for spirits to go up and down on. But as you begin to circle it around the west and then the north face, it becomes very austere indeed until you're actually at the north face. It's a sheer drop of 5,000 feet of an ice-lined precipice, something I've virtually never seen anywhere. The average pilgrim experience is not this esoteric one that I've described, this meditative one. It's much more raw. This is Kailash, a zone of charged sanctity. The Buddhists imagine that the summit of the mountain is inhabited by Dimchog, who's a kind of furious Buddhist guardian deity. And both they and the Hindus imagine that the rocks are alive, that every pinnacle in the valley around is the habitation of some god or spirit or other. Every malformation of rock or every eccentricity of a boulder or a spur is attributed to some god or to some divine action in the past. The footprints of saints and hermits are all about it. The footprints of the Buddha himself are there. And the surviving Bon, and these are the earliest religious adherents in Tibet, they circle the mountain anticlockwise. The people, the worshippers of the peaceful Jain sect, imagine that their first prophet passed away on the slopes of the mountain too, so they are here. The mountain gods, one imagines, were originally pagan, but were converted to Buddhism perhaps 1,000 years ago. And here and there, you find that they're sort of almost lurking there, unacknowledged or half-acknowledged. There's a monastery called Choku, which is on the west side of the mountain. And you go in, and the temples above have got all the conventional Buddhist gods there, the Buddha of the future, the Buddha, and so on, the Amitabha Buddha. Underneath is a disused warehouse. And I sort of had heard about this other god, and rather reluctantly was taken down by a young monk to show me. And you sort of went through darkness virtually, and swathed in these white shawls was this demonic figure, who was the god of the mountain, the original god of the mountain, Kangre Latsen, who was still being worshipped in a rather almost sort of undercover way, just for those who knew. He had a sort of leering face, I remember, and women were not allowed to visit him for some reason, but the men went in and gave him sacrificial scarves. Hindu pilgrims, of course, see here a landscape of their own as opposed to the Buddhist. Sometimes overlaps with the Buddhist, of course, but it's a different one. I was surprised to see many coming down anti-clockwise, which is just the way you don't want to come. And I thought they must be the Bon at first, but they weren't. They were Indian pilgrims who had failed to reach the high pass around the mountain and were coming back the wrong way. They looked so dispirited and ashen-faced and had little canisters of oxygen which they were discarding among the rocks. And these were worshippers of Shiva, of course, whose mountain this is. And many of these come from Bangalore and Chennai and lowland parts of India. And they have no idea what they're letting themselves in for. There's an Indian government lottery that allows about 1,000 to come. And they are passed with health checks and so on. But a lot of unscrupulous Hindu, Indian tour operators in India get people and they pass no test. They have no idea what they're coming in for. They're mostly middle class, pious, quite wealthy, and they come up from the Indian plains. They're flown from Kathmandu to Lhasa, perhaps. That's already 8,000 feet leap. They're trucked 3 or 4 days across west from Lhasa to Mount Kailash. At 15,000 feet, they're then expected to go another 3,500 feet. And many of them simply couldn't do it. They would come back. About one-third of most groups found themselves unable. 8 of them died on the mountain while I was there of oedema and heart failure. For the rest, Buddhist and Hindu, the mountain pilgrimage has a sort of trajectory of redemption, which is quite remarkable. As you go around the mountain, at about 17,000 feet, you come to a place called Shivatsal, which is a cemetery. They call it a cemetery. It's actually where people discard an article of clothing, either that or maybe a tooth or a tress of their hair or even drops of their blood. It's a sign that they are leaving behind their old life. It's also a memento to the god of death to look after them. But basically, it's a sign that they're shedding their old personality and moving on through a cleansed atmosphere towards redemption, which happens at the high pass of 18,600 feet, named to the Tara, the goddess of compassion. Some way beyond that cemetery, where I saw that even the rocks were clothed with people's, what the clothes people had left behind. And I was waiting there for a while, and there was a sort of bundle of rags raised to its feet, and it was an old man who had been practicing death. He grinned at me and walked on, but that's what people do there. They lie there thinking about their future death, sometimes under the tutelage of a holy man. And then they go on in a state, you might say, of mystical death, until they get a renewed life at the top of the pass. There's a rather grim peak called Shamari, which is the next thing they come to, called the Mirror of the King of Death. And this reflects back to them, they imagine, all their past sins. By now they're at about 17,500 feet, and you come to an area where there are big boulders, and these are called sin-testing stones. And again, there's a feeling that the earth is living, that it understands you and what you are. And if you can squeeze between some of these stones, it is said to be the proof that you are sinless. If you'd fail to squeeze through the stones, it's because they squeeze you tight and trap you there, because the earth knows. The Tibetans treat this with some jollity, I have to say. I found a number of them sitting outside one of these little tunnels between the rocks, and they described to me how the year before they had had a particular fat friend who they wanted to drag through, and for about half an hour, two of them pushed him and two of them pulled him, and eventually they got him through, covered in dust and blood, but apparently sinless. They wanted me to do this too, but luckily the gap was blocked solid by ice when I was there, so I wasn't put through that. So this is a place, as you go higher, where people sometimes die. The Hindu dead are flown back to India. Some others have been known to be just left on the mountain. I wasn't afraid so much of sort of muscular fatigue, although it was hard, but of altitude sickness, which can hit anybody at any time. There's really no cure for it. But oddly enough, my Sherpa got headaches, and I didn't. I don't know why this was to this day. And finally, at the top of the pass, this pass has an enormous rock there, sacred, of course, to the goddess of compassion. And it's this place that brings redemption. It's so swathed in prayer flags, and these great poles of prayer flags, the gales that's come screaming through the pass have toppled them all over. But if you part them, you can see the mantra and the mantras and the teeth sometimes and the tresses of hair plastered against the great rock. And there's a wonderful sense of relief and delight among the pilgrims, Buddhist and Hindu together, who've reached here, and shamans sometimes leap to their feet, shouting, victory to the gods. You may ask, of course, what is being redeemed here, because essentially the belief is in a depersonalized karma. There's no individual survival to the Buddhists and Hindus. There's no memory. This is a tradition grander, you might say, than ours, and less intense, in which what matters is not the individual, but the burden of karma, of good or evil, that exists in the world. In a celebrated passage of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna addresses Arjuna the archer before battle, saying, "Thou hast mourned those who should not be mourned, nor at any moment was I not, nor thou, nor these kings, and not at all shall we ever come not to be." So these two warriors go into battle, hewing men down with those exalted smiles that we see on the statues of Hindu gods, because they know they're killing nothing of importance. In fact, that the erasure of the individual is the condition of salvation. A monk that I knew in Kathmandu, a monk called Tashi, described Buddhism not as a religion and not even as a philosophy. He said it's a science. At its highest, he said it's a technique of true realization. As he told me, we have no God, we have no soul. And this, of course, offers no comfort to somebody in mourning from a Christian tradition. But as the Buddhists say, from all that he loves, man must part. Expatriate Tibetans like him often said rather pathetically to me, we can't go to Kailash. If we go over to the Tibetan border, the police will get us. It's only you who can go. And there's a custom at this highest point of the pilgrimage that you leave a token of your passage somehow, a garment, a tooth, whatever it may be. And this monk Tashu had become a friend to give me incense to leave for him. And I lit these among the prayer flags in this icy wind and then started down. On the Nepalese-Tibetan border, my horse drover had had to leave me, and I asked him on parting, since he wasn't so young, when he's going to stop working in this arduous way. And he answered, I will finish when the journey of my life is over. Perhaps it's natural in most cultures to conceive life as a journey, and a travel book is itself like the Odyssey or the Babylonian epic of Gilgamesh, for that matter, falls somewhat into this pattern, rather like a classical novel or symphony. Starts out with some kind of aspiration and object, passes perhaps through conflict, tribulation, maybe danger, and ends up with some sort of resolution or homecoming. It would be comforting to claim that my journey was in this mold and had in some way been cathartic or revelatory or had brought me home. But while pilgrims traditionally go towards their historical and cultural centre, the travel writer moves away from it in the opposite direction towards the unknown. Thank you very much for listening. I will attempt to answer any questions if anybody has any. I can't guarantee. The first one is always the difficult one. Yes? There's a microphone coming your way, I think.
With digital photography so easy compared to slides, did you not take any pictures? I mean, you can take thousands with practically a pocketful. So, and the second question, if you didn't, is there some article in National Geographic or other travel magazines about this place?
You'll certainly be able to find photographs of them online. There are plenty. My reasons for not taking a camera have been very much to do with my profession. I've mainly travelled in the ex-Soviet Union, Central Asia, China, and one good reason for not taking a camera is when the police look over your luggage and find no camera, they assume no spy. And that's one practical reason for not taking a camera. Another is that it's a publishing thing, really, that illustrations in a travel book, if one were to include them, give back to the person that's looking at them their own eyes, as it were. You're seeing, you know, your own eyes. What the travel writer's doing in his book, however, is to let you see through his eyes, with his particular sensibility or aesthetic preferences, whatever it may be, you're looking through the eyes of another. And that, in a way, is the value of the travel book and why many publishers think it's better not to have illustrations. I did take a camera with this for this book, but only to register the look of things, rather like making notes, which is what I normally do. So there are sort of multiple reasons for not taking a camera for me. One of the other reasons is that I'm obsessive, and if I had a camera, I would be looking all the time to see, looking at composition, as photographers do, or the play of light, all those things which are pretty much irrelevant to travel writing. So There are not a lot of reasons for my not doing so, but you will find plenty of illustrations in other places.
I wonder what you had for dinner, and you must be very disciplined in recording what happened on a given day. How do you capture your experience, and does that just form the fundament of your writing? Do you then rework it once you get back? So what's your evening like on the trek?
Dinner, well, you eat for survival, not pleasure. And my Sherpa and cook had rather disgusting noodles and stuff, which I had to put up with mainly. In the Tibetan homes, it was pretty much the same. Good bread, nice bread. But mostly they were too poor to do much more than share an egg with you if you were lucky. As for recording my experiences, I don't much like this, but you've more or less answered my question. There's a fundament, as you call it, of notes. I take notes all the time during my journey, and they are very full. They're sort of lavish. I always imagine that after an encounter or seeing a beautiful landscape or striking building, that I'm going to remember it. I say, I'm bound to remember this. But you don't. And after many months of travel, everything's sort of blurred together. You can remember more or less what a conversation with somebody went like or more or less what a stretch of landscape looked like. But you don't remember the detail. And it's the detail that gives life to the description, not just the generality, but the particular expression somebody used, or the particular color of that building, the texture of the stone. And all those things I have to note down in books, which makes it very self-conscious. I don't like it, but I don't know what the way is out of it. So that's how it happens. And then I get the notes back to England, if I'm lucky. So far I've been lucky. And then I start to work from the notes to create proper text. Somebody there.
Hello, sir. Having recently returned from Tibet, do you have a personal opinion as to whether Westerners should travel to Tibet and potentially support the Chinese regime as opposed to staying outside and protesting?
This is the potent question one might have of any regime. Burma, of course, comes to mind, Myanmar. I've never known quite how to answer this. I think, on the whole, that exposure to the Western gaze is the way ahead for some sort of humanitarian treatment of the Tibetans. And the more there's a Western witness to what's happening there, and the same goes for Xinjiang, for northwest China, the better it is. That's a view I held with some trepidation. But Tibet, the Chinese are not going to relinquish Tibet. Any encouragement for the Tibetans to rebel would be very irresponsible. They'll be mercilessly crushed, as they have been. And one can only encourage them to keep their own culture alive and to hope for better times ahead.
You talked about going into the unknown. But quite obviously, you prepare. And I'm not talking about lists of what to take and all of that. But you do a tremendous amount of background research. And I'm curious to know how you stage that and how you limit that before you go so that you're not carrying other people's vision and you remain fresh to the immediate experience?
That's an interesting, troubling question, of course, and I was always conscious of how much burden of other people's preconceptions you're carrying with you. I tend to research fact, if I can, whether it's archaeological, architectural, historical, as much as you can call it objective fact, rather than opinion. But there comes a time when you instinctively know, at least I think I do, in research, where you're getting subsumed by too much, and then it's time to depart. What I have mainly done, though not in the case of this book, is to attempt to learn the language of the countries that I travel through, so you get the version of others rather than traveling with your own. I've struggled all my life with Mandarin Chinese and Russian, at least to be able to communicate with people. And that is a great, I think, buttress against too much accepted opinion. You're getting a whole lot of other opinions. But it's a problem. There was some other part of your question that I think I haven't answered.
I think you did pretty well with the answer.
Thank you. Right. There's somebody here, a lady here.
How did you get started writing travel writing?
A fascination first with words before travel. As a child, I loved writing, loved poetry. I was the kind of child that wrote horrible odes to everything that came under my vision. So that was the first thing. Later, my father was a military man, a military diplomat, and was in the States and in Canada. And I was a child out of war-torn London, and which I can still only just remember, but England was incredibly drab at that time. I'd never seen a neon light in my life. And suddenly, my father was working in Washington and then in Ottawa for 3 or 4 years. And I was at school in England, but would cross the Atlantic on those awful old four-engine Stratocruisers and have my holidays in America and Canada. It was absolute revelation. And, you know, to imagine a child out of bombed, blitz London standing in Times Square, even in 1947, I can remember it to this day vividly, and the great landscapes of Canada, the great lakes and rivers. It was an absolute revelation, and I think that gave me an idea that abroad was wonderful, and gave me a sort of yen and perhaps a romanticism about it. So the love of writing and the love of traveling came together really in my late teens. And it seemed natural because there's a great English tradition of travel writing, much stronger than here. I mean, writing travel narratives that the two combined. Thank you very much. And I see we've overrun our time. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.